Welcome to the Big Drink Rethink podcast with me, your host, Anna Donaghy. If you've noticed that the drinking culture in the UK is changing and you're curious about why and what this means to your world, then this is the podcast for you. Throughout this series, I will be chatting with the thought-provoking, forward-thinking people at the heart of this shift to find out what makes them tick and to explore the sober curious perspective from all angles. And I'll also be giving you oodles of personal tools and tactics to help you get on board the Big Drink Rethink. Hello and welcome to the show. So my goal through the Big Drink Rethink is to talk to the people and brands who are helping to shift our culture around drinking, be that through knowledge they bring, perspectives they have to share, their own unique experiences, innovation, etc. And from the outset, I did have some people on my hit list and others I have been very lucky to be meeting along the way. And my guest today is one such lady. Helen Jeffrey is a writer, a performer, a director and a creative facilitator that I am thrilled to be welcoming onto the show to discuss how her work, and the arts in general, to be honest, can really challenge and provoke debate around our relationship with alcohol and reflect society's changing dynamics. So welcome to the show, Helen. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me, Anna.
Oh, it's a real pleasure. I was going to talk about how we met, because as I say, we've met relatively recently, and I was going to talk about that. But why don't you explain that? Because A, I've already talked enough, and B, you can probably best explain what you were trying to do at the time and why you were doing it and how our paths crossed.
Yeah, sure. So I knew that I had a play that was going into production, and I'd applied for Arts Council funding, and it's quite difficult to get, but I gave myself a couple of shots at it before we were due to go into rehearsal. And sadly, I failed in both my attempts to get funding, which isn't unusual in the current climate, I have to say. That's something we can talk about a bit later. Obviously, for me, it was never going to be an option to not do the production because I'd invested too much heart, time, soul into it. And also, you know, I had a theatre that was willing to put it on and support me in the production of it. But obviously productions have a certain amount of costs, and I wanted to make sure that my actors, above all else, were going to be paid. I think as creatives, you know, we're quite used to taking a hit sometimes ourselves if a project is important to us, but I would never expect anybody that I work with to not be paid. So I thought, right, I need to be a little bit inventive here. So I started to think about other ways that I could get some income in. And one of those was to start looking for a sponsor and also advertising space. So I kind of looked on Instagram and socials and did my own hit list, which I think Anna was one of them. And was very, very grateful / surprised when Anna came back and said that she would like to help. And here we are. Anna wanted to help. We had a chat. She was interested and wanted to support what I was doing. And and that's how we met. So it's great, and hopefully the start of a beautiful friendship.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I was going to say, here we are, and hopefully it is a start. Power of LinkedIn. It's great, isn't it? When it works, it really works. And it was one of those moments where I just thought, I love this, you know, an alignment, I suppose, of mission and values. I could see straight away what you were trying to do with the performance and your message within the performance, and the line of inquiry, really, the exploration behind, you know, the story of the play. And I just thought that is bang on, you know, what the Big Drink Rethink is all about. So I'm obviously going to ask you about the play and give you oodles of chance. There's loads of things I want to dig into about the play itself. But this arts funding piece, just to sort of move on from that quickly, is it really hard to get arts funding these days because of the climate, the economic climate, for any type of project? Or is it particularly hard for projects of this type, Helen? I genuinely don't know how that works, and obviously you do.
Well, I genuinely don't know either how you know, whether it's projects of this kind. I mean, I still see plenty of funding going into huge, big NPO organisations. But I think for perhaps more regional-based stuff, perhaps there's, you know, certain criteria that has to be fulfilled. And I certainly feel you know, from what I can see, that it's not really even about sometimes the quality of the piece. It's about how you're going to fulfill the criteria of whatever the funding stream happens to be. So, you know, I know that the Arts Council have recently rejigged it, but obviously reaching communities, people and places, you know, that their investment principles are all very, very clear. And, you know, I had hoped with a piece like this that it would be able to, you know, tick some of those boxes, but perhaps, you know, it's something that I just need to go back and tweak. So it's definitely not over yet, because it is a very fundable piece. I believe that. And on another attempt, I could well get the funding. So I think I'm hearing more and more that artists are getting their funding on the third or even the fourth attempt of a bid now. It's just tweaking and refining it. But in terms of getting money to put a play on, it doesn't seem that that is enough. It's not about product, it's about process, and it's about engaging communities. And rightly so, you know, engaging communities to come and watch shows that perhaps wouldn't necessarily engage with the arts. But who is to determine what is a suitable, you know, project for that? I guess that's what's difficult for you as an artist, because all you get is a yes or a no ultimately, and information like, you know, there were other projects that were more fundable. So, you know, I believe it's something like about 8% of projects are getting funded at the moment. And speaking to my my peers in the industry, very few people seem to be getting it at the moment. So, yeah, sign of the times, I think.
Yeah, definitely sign of the times. And it sounds like luck of the draw and, you know, lots and lots of factors, as you say, well beyond your control. But let's talk about the play, because we're sort of talking around it without actually having much. It's called Buckled.
It is.
Isn't it? And you mentioned regionality. It has been a regional performance, but it is, you know, the thing that clearly piqued my interest is it is something of national interest. It's a very, very relevant topic and theme for play to cover. What's it about? Why don't you tell listeners what it's about if they haven't been lucky enough to see it, or if they're not within the region where they're going to be able to catch it shortly?
In a nutshell, the piece is about navigating sobriety in a world that revolves around drinking. And it focuses around three characters who are all connected, all have a very different relationship to each other and to alcohol. And it's centered around an impending wedding. Again, you know, an occasion that for many people, alcohol is at the center of. And it's about, you know, whether one of the characters will be invited to the wedding or not. And about so much more, really, apart from that. So, yeah, it's really looking at, you know, why is it that so many of our interactions in society seem to be focused around drinking? And if you choose not to, it's almost like you're bucking the norm and there's something that's wrong with you. Why is that? So, you know, it's not at all a preachy piece, because, you know, as somebody who myself, you know, used to drink too much and has made a decision not to drink now for about 3.5 years, I will be the last person in the world that would ever want to tell anybody that they're not to drink. But I think good theatre, well, actually any good artwork, it should pose questions. It should get people talking about things. It should make people think. If it does any of those things, it's done its job, really. And also it should be entertaining and fun, because let's not forget that a lot of people drink to have a good time. So the piece should feel like it's a Friday night. You know, people are going to come to the theatre. Why on earth would they come and see a play about not drinking? Well, it's certainly not just a play about not drinking. You know, it's a play about so much more than that. And anybody who's ever had a horrible hangover, or has ever questioned whether perhaps they're drinking a bit too much, or even anybody who just wants to have a few drinks while they're watching the show, although that's something we'll maybe come back to, I think, you know, they'll enjoy it. So I think hopefully it'll be a good night out as well.
Yeah, no, let's come back to that, because I'll be slightly intrigued to see how many people drank their way through the show. But no, there's a lot in there, and definitely I want to come back as well and talk about how you strike the balance between, you know, entertaining and, you know, providing an evening of entertaining whilst talking about something quite serious in many, many ways. But right back to where you started there. You mentioned your own experience. Buckled is drawing from your own experience to a degree, I'm assuming, therefore, the inspiration for it.
It's drawing on my own experience of navigating sobriety. The story of the central characters is not mine, but has come from research that I have done. So, yeah, looking at it, we've got the central character is Maggie, She's 50 and she's in active recovery. So she's almost 6 months sober. And her son, Callum, they have not had any contact since Maggie stopped drinking. In fact, Callum doesn't even know that his mother is, you know, in recovery at this moment. So Callum, in effect, you know, has been a victim of his mother's alcoholism for a number of years. She doesn't use the word alcoholic to describe herself. He does use the word, and that's something that, you know, is a contentious word, alcoholic. And it's one that I'm not quite sure, you know, whether I wasn't sure whether to use in the piece or not. But we've got it in there because that's how Callum views her. It's not how Maggie sees herself. And I think, you know, again, there's something to unpick there as well. The only thing that's alcoholic is a drink. It's a drink that's alcoholic or non-alcoholic. A person has a dependency or an unhealthy relationship with alcohol. So, you know, that's looked at. And then you've also got a character called Ruby. And Ruby's 30, one of Callum's oldest friends. And she is drinking far too much and for the wrong reasons. And, you know, as we see Maggie kind of taking great strides on her journey of navigating sobriety and asking some of those questions that I asked on my journey, as she seems to get stronger, we see Ruby kind of declining even more and more. And, you know, I don't want to give too much away about how the play ends, but, you know, it's not a happy ending, but it's also not a sad ending. It's what we might call an open ending. It is open to
thank goodness for that.
Yeah.
It's one of those things where, you know, I want to ask you about the characters, but I also know I don't want you to give too much away because there is still a chance to see it and there's going to be a chance to catch it online as well, as far as I'm aware. So, yeah. You know, I want to keep that element of sort of real interest and intrigue. But we'll talk about some of the research you did in a minute. But straight away, even as you give that sort of top line about Maggie's maternal relationship with Callum, Callum's perception of drink and drinking versus Maggie and how she identifies versus how he would identify her problems. I mean, I hear this all the time. I yeah. see it in so many relationships. And, you know, I think you've hit anyway there straight away on a really important thought and principle about the term alcoholic. And I loved what you said about a drink is alcoholic, but it's not necessarily a label that we should ascribe to an individual. We don't do it in any other context. We don't call people who smoke nicotineaholics, or people who eat too much or for the wrong reasons foodaholics. But we do, and it's a society thing. It's our long established convention. We don't have a better term, so we use that, don't we?
Well, that point that I made about, you know, only a drink is alcoholic or non-alcoholic came on, you know, through audience feedback. So again, that's been a really important piece of the process here for me, is that this play has gone through several stages of, you know, being shown to an audience, getting response and feedback. And, you know, the first thing I had to think about when I was writing it was, is this a show people want to watch? So it started off as a scratch. And for people who don't know, a scratch is when you take a 10-minute extract of something that you've written, you put it on its feet in front of an audience, and then you ask them questions about it. It's really useful for a writer to know, am I along the right lines? What needs developing? What's working and what isn't? And the first question I asked was, is this a play that you want to see more of? And everybody went, yes, you know, we do. We want to know. We're invested in the characters and the themes of this piece, because it's in everybody's life. Alcohol in some way or another is in everybody's life. So, you know, the feedback's been really important. We did a work in progress where we did a Q&A. And again, that's the next stage. A work in progress is where the actors have got the script in their hands, but they're reading it. And again, you know, you have the audience feedback afterwards and the questions, and then you go through to your final draft. So I'm on about draft 6 at the moment. And I'd like to think it's nearly done. But of course, it's a bit like, you know, how do you ever know when something's really done? I think when you go through it and the changes become less and less and less, and you finally get to a point where you think, I can stop editing now, I think I'm happy with it.
With any sort of creative practice like that, you at some point you have to, don't you? You have, for your own sanity as well, you have to sort of draw the line. But it's really interesting, because within my coaching realm, I am always coming across and talking to clients whose family dynamics have been really conflicted with alcohol. So, you know, I'm very, very aware of the fact that, you know, for many people listening to this podcast, their interest in alcohol and, you know, the aspiration of drinking less is not necessarily something that they will be internalizing themselves, but it might be something that they're thinking of with regards to sort of family members, friends, etc. I mean, just thinking about Maggie there, I talk a lot, and it's really common to speak to maybe sort of middle-aged or slightly older people whose real reason for wanting to drink less or not at all is so that they can spend time with their grandchildren, be put in charge with their grandchildren, you know, earn back the respect or trust, maybe after an incident or whatever, of, you know, of their own children, and be allowed back into sort of childcare and things like that, which is, you know, it's heartbreaking, but it's very, very real. Mm-hmm. And likewise, I get contacted by mums and dads who say, I think my son or daughter, X, Y, and Z, needs help. So there are, you know, these generational concerns and these generational conflicts are incredibly relevant and incredibly, I suppose, I was going to say prolific, but there are very few families, I think, who aren't affected in some shape or form by an alcohol dynamic of some degree.
I think, you know, certainly there's genetic, you know, predisposition to dependency on substances, whether that's alcohol or something else, environmental factors, but also, you know, just patterns that you see. You know, something becomes the norm, it very easily becomes a routine, doesn't it? And yeah, because I wasn't brought up in a house where lots of people were drinking all of the time, which was why it was really important that for me to understand the character of Callum, that I were to actually go and speak to people who were the children of alcoholics, to use the frame. So I spoke, there's an association called National Association of Children of Alcoholics. And, you know, I spoke to them, and I also did, you know, research and case studies and spoke and recorded interviews with people. And it's all anonymized, but some of the experiences they shared helped to form some of the narrative and those key moments. And, you know, thinking about our own upbringing and our own milestones in our lives, how many of them is alcohol at the center of in some way, whether it's your 18th, it's your wedding, it's, you know, your graduation, whatever it is. It's always at the forefront, isn't it? Funerals even, you know, there's always an excuse, isn't there, to have a drink. And so I think in some ways that was really important for me to, you know, to get that right.
Yeah. Well, and as you say, I mean, all of those, just by being able to list the sheer numbers of occasions where alcohol is, you know, central to it, brings it into sharp focus. It's an incredibly alcohol centric society. So that whole your byline around the play was around, you know, navigating a world where alcohol is everywhere. And yeah. And I think that's it. And I you know, your choice of a wedding is honing in on one of the biggest, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's one that people have spoken to me about. Oh God, do you remember when this happened or that happened or there was a fight? Or, you know, because it's not the drinking per se that's an issue. It's all of the things that happen because of the drinking. You know, drink isn't going to punch someone in the face. You know, it's the same with drugs, isn't it? It's not the drug itself is not the issue. It's what happens to you when you take it, and the behaviours, or, you know, whether they're self-destructive behaviours or behaviours that affect other people as well. So, you know, that's one thing, going slightly off tangent, but one thing I do not miss now is hangovers and anxiety, that oh God, you know, what did I say anything last night? Did I upset anybody? And, you know, we see Ruby go through that in the play, where, you know, it's that awful moment of not really remembering what happened the night before and having to piece it together by like looking at phone messages and then remembering, you know, that awful feeling, which I think most people can identify with.
So again, without giving too much away, is Ruby aware of the fact that her drinking is spiraling?
No, not really. Or she's not ready to go there. You know, she's not everything's starting to go wrong for Ruby. And what Ruby can't piece together is the fact that alcohol is the one consistent thing, you know. So maybe like work's not going well, relationships aren't going well, family's not going well. And what she can't see is that, you know, there is a common denominator here, which is your relationship with alcohol, which is affecting them all. So a lot, you know, you've only got a problem if you see it's a problem, you know. So for Ruby, it doesn't matter if somebody else tells her it's a problem. She's got to feel it for herself. So, and I think that's the same with many of us. We have the niggle, which was where my sort of the inception of this play came from. Which was, you know, tell yourself it's not a problem. You don't have an issue. You could stop anytime you wanted, but you don't. I mean, that's how the play opens. The play opens with the niggle, and it's interlaced with spoken word. And, you know, and I think that gives it a little bit of kind of light relief and a shift in pace for the audience as well, which is important as a writer to kind of think about the audience experience at the theatre. Yeah, that niggle, I think, is perhaps there in Ruby, but she's not willing to admit it, certainly.
And at the same time, Maggie has gone past the point of niggle and has actually done something about her drinking, but hasn't necessarily communicated this with Callum.
Well, she's tried, but he's not wanted. He's cut off contact with her because ultimately the last contact they had with each other, she really, really embarrassed him. And I think for anybody who is the parent of, the child of an alcoholic, I think they will have plenty of their own stories to tell about times when they've been very embarrassed by their parent or the member of family, you know. And he, you know, that was kind of a catalyst for him to go, I don't want to see you again until you stop drinking. Now, of course, with the wedding coming up, you know, shall I invite her, shall I not? And I think he agrees to meet her. And of course, when she tells him she stopped drinking, he's absolutely thrown by that because he doesn't believe for one minute that she has and that she's stuck to it. And instead of feeling really, really pleased and proud of that, he's actually angry. And I think that's what needs unpicking here, because it's not enough for somebody, like he's wanted his mum to stop drinking for so long and now she has. He doesn't quite know what to do with that information. And he's wondering why she couldn't do it all those years ago when he really needed her to. So it's quite complex. It's quite layered. It's a bit like an onion, this play. You know, you get so far and then we take another layer off and another layer off.
It sounds brilliantly insightful. I mean, it really does, because again, you know, a lot of the things that you're talking about there are very, very real, you know, issues for people. Again, you know, a lot of the people I speak to, people who, it's almost as if, you know, someone would have a drinking problem. The work that they go through to put themselves on the right track and to sort and challenge that drinking problem out is huge. And of course, you know, you're very likely to feel once you've done that, that first of all, you're incredibly proud of yourself. You feel that you deserve the sort of the trust and the support and the pride of other people in your family, but there's ongoing sort of distrust, you know, a misunderstanding, a sort of a nervousness, a lack of certainty as to how to still operate and move around people. And as you say, just deal with that information.
That's really interesting. You said that about proud, feeling proud and pride, because I think Maggie, at that point when she tells Callum that, you know, I'm nearly 6 months sober, she feels proud, but it doesn't take very long for that pride to be deflated, and for her to then have to start digging a lot deeper, because, you know, the stopping drinking is only the first part of it. It's when you're faced with a challenge that makes you want to drink again, and you've got nowhere to go with that because you've used alcohol to numb your emotions for so long that suddenly it's overwhelming, and that desire to you know, to numb again, what do you do with that? It's very, very painful. And what Maggie has to go through is not just that I've stopped drinking. She has to unpick the shame. She has to unpick the regret. And, you know, shame is a hugely prevalent emotion in the piece that comes out. You know, the shame that Callum has felt because he never really told anybody how bad his mum's drinking was, and he covered up for her a lot, which many children of alcoholics do. And, you know, and the shame that Maggie feels when she has to face that, because ultimately, you know, she wants to make amends, to use a term that they use, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous. So it's not specific that it's AA that she goes to, but the story's partly told through Maggie in a meeting. And then Callum is in his own meeting. He's in his own kind of support group, because again, it was that, that direct address to the audience is there within the play, because it's a way of connecting. And, you know, it's quite an emotional piece as well. You know, I mean, there's been people sat there crying, watching it. You know, I've had a lot of hugs after it as well. You know, people wanting to come and just give you a hug and talk and share. And, you know, it, it opens up doorways to conversations, and it's hopefully going to destigmatize some of that shame that people like Maggie and Callum are feeling.
Yeah. I know you have your own drinking background as well, and I certainly have mine, which I've been very open about. And the shame is, you know, the shame connected to drinking and to getting into a place where, you know, first of all, you know, you've potentially lost control of your drinking, but also you're beginning to impact relationships and the people around you is absolutely huge. And of course, there's nothing like a sense of shame to keep a drinker drinking in a way. I know that sounds incredibly counterintuitive because it can be the very thing that you're shameful about. But of course, if you're drinking to manage your emotions and that overarching emotion is shame, then it's a very much a sort of self-perpetuating pattern and one that is incredibly difficult to break.
And I mean, it's a coping mechanism. Ultimately, most people drink. Now, I'll rephrase that. I don't know most people drink. Many people drink. For whatever reason, whether it's to relax, whether it's to decompress, whether it's to avoid, you know, whatever the reason, you know, there's something there. And actually, you know, instead of sort of demonizing people who do have problems with their drinking, in a way, this is a coping mechanism that has enabled them to keep going for as long as they have. They shouldn't be demonized for the drinking. You know, they should be recognized that this person has used this device for a very long time to enable themselves to keep going. What you can't do is just take it away and then give them nothing instead. That's where the talking comes in, or, you know, all the other support as well, because, you know, it's been a huge part of their life. And different people use different coping mechanisms. For some it's food, for some it's drugs, you know, whatever it is. I'm talking about drinking habits. I've just fished out my notebook this morning of kind of where most of a lot of this began. And I think as people, as women, maybe, I don't know, but certainly we're very critical of ourselves, or I was very critical of myself. And I decided that if I was going to stop drinking, I needed to try a different approach. So I thought I need to approach this with kindness to myself, really. And there was a book I read called The Kindness Method.
Yes.
That my friend gave me. And I followed some of the steps in that. And the first thing I did was write a snapshot letter about why I wanted to change my drinking habits. And, you know, I'm not necessarily going to share it all here now, but, you know, some of the things that I put in that were, you know, I know it's not good to drink every day. I don't want my kids to see me as someone who needs to drink to relax and cope with stress. And again, any time that I'm struggling, I'll go back to that snapshot letter and just remind myself again. You know, I actually said, I want to feel like when I choose to drink, it's a choice and not a habit. And actually, what's interesting is that I haven't had a drink since the point I wrote this letter. You know, I want to feel like life is enough for me and that I don't need alcohol to enjoy myself. And I don't want to plan my life around opportunities to drink. So, you know, you've got to do the work, really. You know, if you really want to change your habits, you have to do the work. Yeah.
You've got to do the work. And I will utterly underpin, I mean, I'm aware of the book, The Kindness Method. I'm also, you know, 100% supportive of the fact that it is impossible almost to do any form of work on yourself as far as alcohol is concerned, unless you show yourself real self-compassion, kindness, grace. Alcohol is an addictive substance. It's not just addictive to you or me. It's addictive to humans, you know, and if you drink enough of it in the wrong situations, for the wrong emotions, for the wrong reasons, you will become addicted to it. It is addictive. And I always, you know, stand by that sense of it's not your fault.
Yeah.
If you become addicted to alcohol, it's your responsibility to do something about it. If you don't want your children to believe that it's the appropriate tool with which to tackle all those things that you sort of put in your notes there, Helen, but it's, you know, it's not your fault, but it is your responsibility. And, you know, there's a saying which I latched onto really, really early in my journey, which was around, we're all just doing the best with the tools that we've got. And, you know, if the tool that society very permissively sort of flaunts around as being appropriate to, you know, a plethora of different situations. If that tool is alcohol and it's being offered to us very readily, then, you know, no shit, you end up using it.
Yeah.
You know? But we're all just doing the best with the tools that we've got. And therefore, I 100% agree with you. If you're going to take that particular tool away, you've got to fill the toolbox with other things. You've got to. But being kind to yourself and recognizing in the very first instance that this isn't, you know, just a you problem, it's a many people problem, it's a human problem, it's about, you know, the fundamentals of a relationship between you and a very addictive substance. The compassion, the self-compassion is crucial. And it's really interesting that you mentioned that sort of snapshot letter. One of the things I kind of encourage clients to do who are really very much locked into sort of shame and regret is a forgiveness letter.
I will
say to people, sit down and write yourself a forgiveness letter and sign it off, I forgive you, and literally get that shame out into the open where it can't actually survive anymore.
One of the kind of the key scenes in the play is a letter, you know, that Maggie writes Callum, and she, you know, it's called Making Amends. But, you know, she raises that very important point, which is sometimes you have to think about who you're writing the letter for. And, you know, is it kinder not to send it? Because, you know, like yourself, you know, write the letter, but if you know it's going to cause more pain to the person, then you might not want to send it. And you have to recognize that as well. So, you know,
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely a big proponent of writing a letter to yourself in the first instance, you know, to forgive yourself for all the things that you may be sort of harboring shame and regret about. And also, I know that this sounds sort of sometimes slightly intuitive, because when people have a reason to want to give up alcohol, they can often state it as being to improve the relationships within the family or to win back the trust of my son or whatever it might be. But it's really, really important, in my opinion, to also really try and root the why you want to do this in yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, the ripple effect. So poor Maggie, who's kind of thinking, blink and flip, I've been sober for 6 months. What the hell do I have to do to prove myself to this person? Time is a healer. If you're doing it simply to win back that relationship, then you can very quickly get into, you can't control how other people feel. Time can make sure that those kind of things slot into place, but that's why the relationship you have with yourself has got to be the primary driver, because that's something you can have much more control over.
Absolutely. And yeah, that I can, you know, that scene where Callum says, what am I supposed to be impressed now? And, you know, she said she's done it because she knows how important it is, because, you know, she wants to get invited to the wedding. And, you know, this whole thing about will she, won't she be invited to the wedding as well, you know. So I picked a wedding because there could have been any number of things, really, but it's one of those occasions, isn't it, when, you know, there is just so much alcohol. And I remember people being extremely drunk at my own wedding. I'm paying for all this. But yeah, I think the idea for a lot of people of going to a wedding and not drinking is an alien one, isn't it? And that was one of the first hurdles I had to get over as a non-drinker. I think I've been about 7 months without alcohol when I had to tackle that particular one. I was dreading it, you know, a wedding without alcohol. And then you've got birthday and you've got Christmas, and you just have to, once you've done them, those milestones, it gets a little bit easier, doesn't it? You know, but certainly for someone like me, Maggie asks the question, I do wonder sometimes whether I might ever be able to drink normally again. Again, the question's not answered. It's something she asks, you know, I do wonder that. Whereas for me, I used to wonder that a lot, and I still do sometimes, you know, like maybe I will, maybe I'll get to 80 and I'll go like, oh, you know, sod it. I'll just, you know, start drinking again. I don't know. But just taking it off the table makes, for me, taking it off the table completely is a relief, because I don't have to make any of those decisions then about how much, when, you know, anything like that. So I think it's also knowing yourself as a person and the kind of person that you are. You know, if you know that you're not somebody that finds it easy to moderate, then just remove that as an option. It's like, you know, I was a vegetarian for 25 years and I ate bacon one day. And 10 years later, I'm still eating meat. So is it worth the risk? You know, that's the question.
I think it's, I think, you know, I mean, we could go and have a very long chat about that sort of the psychology of never again. When you start exploring giving up drinking or drinking a lot less, I would always say, you know, don't be fixated on where it's going to end up, you know, what this means 10 years down the line, or even at that wedding, 7 months down the line or 8 months down the line. Think about what it means to you today and, you know, just keep checking in with yourself on how you're feeling, and the future will take care of itself. Because, of course, if we tell ourselves never again, then the brain has some kind of mental tantrum. It's a sort of very intangible period of time, but you can say not today.
Yeah.
You can say not tomorrow. And then before you know it, you're saying, well, it wasn't last week or the week before. And you're building up a body of evidence of how you feel.
It really does sometimes do a number on you, doesn't it? Like, you know, there was a time not that long ago when, God, the impulse for me to just go to the shop and buy a bottle of red wine, it was really quite overwhelming. And, you know, I had to really stop and kind of, you know, come on, don't question the decision. You know, you spent a lot of time making this decision. And also, I'm a stubborn sod, so I like the fact that I've reached a milestone and I don't want to have to go back to zero again, you know. But
yeah.
But if you do, you know, if you're somebody that is questioning your relationship with alcohol and you do, you know, you do lapse or you do drink from time to time, you know, it's not the end of the world, is it? You know, so I suppose, again, it's that kindness. But I know for me, you know, it just feels kind of, I'm looking after my emotional sobriety as much as my physical sobriety, you know?
Yes. Yeah, I love that term. And you mentioned something which I'll pick up on really quickly there, because it's that there is definitely an approach to, you know, stopping drinking where you sort of count the days and you sort of accumulate the number of days in which you haven't had a drink. And then, of course, if you suddenly do, you can feel like you're sort of back at square one. And what I always sort of try and encourage people to think about is percentages,
yeah,
and not numbers. So if you used to drink every single day and you've gone 10 days or 9 days without drinking and then suddenly you have a drink, you're not back to day one, because you've had 9 days and you can't have that taken away from you. You can look at that and say, I've drank for 10% of the time that I used to drink. And that's a much more motivating way of looking at it. So, you know, or flipping it even more positively, I didn't drink for 90% of the time in the last 10 days.
Yeah, it's all about how you frame it, really, isn't it? You know, but as human beings, we are, I think, generally predisposed to kind of fixate on the negative, aren't we? You know, and that mindset, I mean, I'm one of those people anyway that, you know, very easily can go into a negative thought spiral, and I have to sort of separate, you know, I'm not my thoughts, and you know, don't have to believe everything that you think. But there was a brilliant little video I came across, which is, it was about, as humans, we want certainty about things all the time, don't we? You know, I want to know that this is the right thing, or, you know, I just want certainty. And this particular guy said, you know, just remove that. Just, well, you know, maybe not. So if I ever think, you know, wonder if I'll ever drink again, you know, maybe I will, maybe I won't. And that's quite helpful, really, just to kind of keep repeating that. Well, you know, who knows? It's the same with the old, you know, is there life after death? Who knows? Maybe, maybe not.
Who knows? Yeah. And that's, I love that, because it's, you know, so, yes, we want certainty, but if you could replace that with just sort of an element of curiosity, you know, maybe, let's see, who knows? I love it. Brilliant. So just very, very quickly then, you mentioned that you'd had sort of comments after the performances of Buckled. And I think you actually had a Q&A, didn't you, after one of the performances. So what were the kind of questions that came up? But did you, you know, you sort of stood there and said, hit me with some questions. What kind of themes were people picking up on? And what were they exactly asking you?
Well, it kind of took a slightly different turn, the Q&A, because initially I wasn't in the piece. So it's a three-hander and I've written it and I'm directing it. But because we had a situation where, unfortunately, through no fault of their own, one of the actors had to pull out at the very last minute, I ended up having to go on stage and be in it. So that in itself was a huge challenge to me, because You know, I was a performer, you know, I trained as an actor, but ever since I've been writing, I've never written anything that I've put myself in. And it was really frightening, to be quite honest. So no wonder that a lot of the questions were focused on, you know, how did it feel to perform that role? And people wanted to know if it was my story, because, you know, again, there's that ghoulish element people love, don't they? Slightly of, you know, oh, was that really what happened to you? And I had to point out that no, you know, Maggie's story was not my experience. It was made up of lots of different experiences, really. So yeah, there was a lot of interest in me and my story, but also people genuinely, I think, wanting to know what the answer is to that question. You know, like, how do you navigate sobriety? You know, if you're somebody that's thinking about it, what are the first steps that you should take? And, you know, I was at pains to point out that I'm not a trained professional. I can't give anybody advice about their drinking. All I can say is that, you know, if you know deep down there's a problem, there's a problem. And if you think that somebody that you love or care about has a problem, it doesn't even matter how many times you tell them it's a problem. If they aren't willing to recognize that, you are in a hiding to nothing. So, you know, all you can do, I suppose, is let people know that, you know, you love them, and maybe offer other suggestions for things to do. You know, I mean, the number of interactions in society that we have, you know, hiya, oh, let's get together for a drink. Why? Why can't we go for a walk? Why can't we go for a coffee? Why can't we, you know, why can't we do any number of other things? So I think it's maybe these are baby steps. But, you know, I think it's, you know, just thinking about that, because that was one of the hardest things for me when I stopped drinking, was worrying I was not going to have a social life at all. And, you know, people making comments, well-meaning, but things like, you know, I hope you're not going to expect me to stop drinking, or, you know, not going to be a party pooper, are you?
Yeah, and, nice one.
Yeah, all those kind of things. Yeah, yeah, which is difficult. And some friendships have fallen by the wayside, most definitely. But then they were not the kind of friendships that necessarily were rooted in the deep and meaningful relationships that I like to have with God, this makes me sound very worthy. I don't mean deep and meaningful. I mean the people that want to spend time with me now want to spend time with me, regardless of whether I'm drinking. So, you know, I'll give you an example. My best mate of many, many years, over 30 years, you know, we've been on holiday together since, and since I've stopped drinking. And she's been on many holidays with me where I drunk her under the table, you know, many nights. And when I said to her, you know, you can have a drink, you know, if you want to, she said, no, I'm not bothered. She said, I'm quite relieved. I don't have to try and keep up with you anymore. So yeah. Non-alcoholic beer with me. She's not bothered. So
it reminded me when you say some friends do fall by the wayside. Yes, if that was the basis of your relationship with them, for sure. It's a really interesting book by a guy called Henry Cloud called Necessary Endings. And he does a brilliant way of sort of explaining that life is full of chapters and seasons. It's not one continual season. It, you know, it changes, and sometimes recognizing when things have to change and doing, making sure that those changes happen on your terms is really, really important. And he introduces this sort of analogy of pruning, that sometimes in order to flourish, you have to prune and make sure that, you know, you get the nourishment and the support that you need. And I'm, whilst I don't want to sound brutal and say you just cut your friends off, it's not that at all. If your friends can't support your choices, then maybe you have to move on without them. It doesn't mean you're on a different path. It might just mean you're a bit further down that path than they are. They might catch up at some point. But for now, you've got to sort of stay resolute.
You have to be true to yourself. And I think, you know, if somebody says to you, oh, you've changed, I would say, of course I bloody have.
Yeah, and we
should.
You know,
God, there'd be something wrong if I hadn't. Oh my goodness, if I was still the same person that I was 35 years ago, then I, you know, that's a real problem, isn't it? Or if I'm still doing those things that I was doing then. So, you know, I go out now in Liverpool is sort of the nearest city to me. I love it. It's best city in the world. And, you know, I see all the young girls, like, you know, out having a good time. And I look back and I think, God, that was me, you know. But would I want it to be me now? No, No, that would be a bit sad, really, if it was still me totching around now, hammered. But, you know, I think that personal growth that, you know, people go through, and maybe it's a middle-aged thing as well, I don't know. I mean, certainly I would never have contemplated a life without alcohol until I hit my 40s, definitely. So maybe it's also something to do with that. I don't know. It can go one way or another. I think drinking can ramp up, or you can start to question.
Yeah, well, hold that thought, because I'm hoping to have a guest on very, very soon who's going to talk about drinking and midlife and identity. So we will be picking that up, and you can listen in and nod along. But yeah.
Oh, I will do, because of course, you know, especially as a woman who's kind of approaching menopause now as well, you know, and the anxiety and everything that can come around drinking, you know, or the effects that drinking can have that, you know, exacerbate your anxiety. I think that's something that's not really spoken about. And, you know, that's probably another podcast really to do with menopause and drinking. You know,
it's another episode. It's another episode. Yeah. I'm working on it. I've loved this conversation. You know, the arts themselves are obviously, it's a brilliant medium through which to sort of have these kind of powerful conversations and to, you know, encourage reflection and, you know, as you say, from the feedback of your audiences, really get sort of foster that empathy and hopefully, you know, inspire positive action too. So just for people listening who are saying, oh my God, I wish I'd seen this play, what's possible for them? What's the next steps of this for you?
So the next show is happening, if you do fancy a weekend in Liverpool, on the 3rd of May, which is Friday, and it's the bank holiday weekend. And it's happening, it's being shown as part of the Up Next Festival at the Unity Theatre. It's a great space, and it's celebrating the work of Merseyside artists. So that there are still tickets available for that show, and I'm doing a Q&A afterwards as well on the 3rd of May. It's also being recorded, so if you fancy the sound of the play but you can't make it, then you should be able to stream it afterwards as well. I'm not quite sure exactly when it will be available yet, but, you know, I'll be updating my socials with that so people can actually pay per view on that one to watch it afterwards.
Brilliant.
Yeah, and then beyond that, well, you know, I'll go in again for some Arts Council funding, definitely. But, you know, it might be that I have to spin it a slightly different way. It might be that I have to think about doing something different with it. I mean, you know, it's a very portable piece and it's a very translatable piece. And with it only being a three-hander, it could go almost anywhere, I would think. So if you're someone listening and you're thinking, well, I wouldn't mind seeing that piece, you know, literally we can get in a car and we can come to you and do it. So, you know, if you're an organisation that would like us to show the piece, I am going to be putting together some educational content around it as well, some workshops and other things, so that it could almost become a little bit of a package. But, you know, it will exist as a piece of art in its own right as well. There's a difference between theatre and education, which I did a lot of when I was younger, that's kind of hammering home a message that this isn't that sort of piece. This isn't telling people not to drink. You know, this is about raising questions and you know, all of those things. But yeah, I mean, if somebody's interested in knowing more or would like to collaborate, you know, I would say get in touch, because, you know, it definitely ain't over after this, that there will be more to come. Has to be more to come.
Has to be. This one has got legs, hasn't it? And it's, you know, it's such a broadly relevant conversation that it has to travel. Okay, well, when you know how people can access it online or the pay-per-view, obviously you'll as you say, you'll go out on your own social with that, but let me know too, because I can communicate it on another episode of the Big Drink Rethink. And
the other thing as well, just to let people know, is it's being captioned, so accessibility is very important to me, and making the arts accessible. So it will be being captioned as well, which does mean as actors that we have to stick to the script, which isn't always easy.
No, I hadn't thought about that. Yeah.
Uh-huh. It's appearing literally at the side of you, and you can imagine the audience going, she didn't say that.
Ad lib. Yeah. Oh, brilliant. Helen, thank you so much. Good luck with the final performance. Good luck with the Q&A, obviously, as well.
Thank you.
And do let us know how we can access it. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me, Anna.
Thank you for listening and getting curious. Please rate, review and follow this podcast on Apple or Spotify or wherever you're choosing to listen. And don't forget to tune in to the next episode. And you can find out more about the Big Drink Rethink by heading to my website, thebeliefscoach.com. That's the beliefs, B-E-L-I-E-F-S, coach.com, where you will see clear links to the show.